in den USA, der Podcast des Heidelberg Center for American Studies. Hello and welcome to a special edition of the HCA podcast. 2 months ago, the death of George Floyd sparked a widespread protest movement against racial injustice and police violence in the United States. While protests in many cities subsided after a few weeks, they continued in a few places, most notably in Portland, Oregon, which has seen demonstrations every night since May 29th. Today, we'll be taking a closer look at those long-standing and intensifying protests and the reaction of the federal government. My name is Anja Schüler, and my guest today is Terrence Wright, who is a native of Oregon and a student in the HCA's Master of American Studies program. He has just recently returned from the United States. So welcome back to Heidelberg, Terrence. I understand that recent trip back to the United States was a little more than you bargained for. Can you briefly describe your experience for our listeners?
Of course. Thanks for having me on. And we planned a trip back to the United States for a sibling's wedding. My brother was getting married. It was supposed to be for 3 weeks, and it ended up being for about 4 months just because of canceled flights due to the coronavirus. It kind of happened overnight just as we arrived, and we ended up staying with my in-laws in Salt Lake City, Utah, for nearly 3 months. And then we went to my family, who's now in California, but also spent some time in Oregon as well. But I'm happy to be back in Germany.
Yeah. And you just got out of quarantine, I understand?
That's right. 14 days of quarantine with my wife and 2-year-old son. We made it.
Okay. Well, it's good to have you back out. So we talked earlier a little bit when I met you on the street yesterday. And this podcast is about the protest movements. And you mentioned to me yesterday that you also actively participated in the protests. Where was that?
Yeah. So when George Floyd was murdered and the protests began across the nation, I was in Salt Lake City in Utah. And although Salt Lake is overwhelmingly white, there were daily protests. And so I felt that it was important to participate and be a part of that collective voice in support of Black Lives Matter and condemning police brutality.
Mm-hmm. So you said they were marching daily. And can you give us some other details? For example, who was typically out there in the streets? What were the demands of the protesters?
Yeah, so whereas the media kind of portrayed the protests as kind of disparate and not very well organized, they did begin with the Black Lives Matter Salt Lake City chapter leading the protests in solidarity with Minneapolis and and demanding police accountability and racial justice. The crowds were, mainly consisted of young adults and were overwhelmingly white, as Utah, as I say, is a very white state. But there was a lot of people that showed up to these marches. And in the beginning, the protests were paired with some pretty inflammatory rioting, I guess. A cop car was flipped and burned. Some buildings were graffitied and federal buildings were doused in paint, which was pretty standard actually throughout the nation, it seemed like. And the police were pretty swift though to deploy, military style tactics, swinging batons and firing tear gas and rubber bullets, bludgeoning protesters. One of the most, I think, famous clips from the Salt Lake City protests was of an elderly man being hit and knocked down by an aggressive policeman, as well as a counter protester who came and with a bow and arrow in support of the police and began to shoot arrows, and which was pretty frightening. I wasn't there that day, but it was pretty frightening to see that. And it was interesting, though, to see the protests in Salt Lake also to begin to reflect more of the demographics and racial makeup of Salt Lake. At the end of May, just a couple days before George Floyd was murdered, Salt Lake City police officers murdered a 22-year-old Latino man named Bernardo Palacios Carbajal, and that was in Utah and Salt Lake. And the police refused to release the body cam footage for like over a month without giving a reason. And people were understandably really upset, especially with what was going on with George Floyd. And so this was all happening during the Black Lives Matter protests. And so when it came out that the officers had, they fired something like 34 shots at Bernardo, even though he was running away from the police. And when they released his body, like his fingers had been blown off because he'd been shot so many times. It's just terrible stuff. And in the end, the Salt Lake City DA did rule that the killing was justified. And at that time, the protests seemed to intensify and it became even more personal in a sense, I think, for Salt Lake City protesters, because it was, you know, it was about George Floyd, Black Lives Matter, but also about this murder of Bernardo. And, you know, I don't think that Bernardo's death would have received the same reaction if it hadn't been for the momentum garnered by Black Lives Matter. And he's also from a neighborhood that my sister-in-law and her family is from. She's Afro-Latina. And so it just felt even more personal that I marched and protested for her, for Bernardo, George Floyd, and other people of color in danger of racist police force.
So you talked a little bit about the reaction of the authorities in Salt Lake City, and have federal forces moved into Salt Lake?
So the National Guard was called out by Utah's governor pretty early on. And so there was a considerable military presence throughout the marches and protests. It was kind of, you know, actually frightening. And so after the initial protest, there was also a citywide curfew issued by the Democratic mayor. So it kind of seemed like, you know, both sides were against the protesters, it felt like.
So have the protests subsided since in Salt Lake City?
In Salt Lake City, more or less, there were some protests that were ongoing because of Bernardo's death and what came out from the Salt Lake City DA's office. And, you know, a lot of the demands had to do with, you know, the police funding being diverted to education. That hasn't happened. And so there seemed to be kind of an indifference, it almost felt like. But I think maybe one of the most potent results, though, of the protests was that they did, you know, start a discussion at some, you know, I think in one level at the universities, you know, whether or not my alma mater, for example, Brigham Young University, should include a class on race and ethnicity as part of their general education requirements for all, you know, first year and second year students. And so between like the DA's decision on Bernardo, the funding of the police not really happening, and then the treatment of protesters, while there weren't any immediate changes, I think that really brought, you know, the issue of racial injustice to a lot of, you know, kind of content white middle class Utahns that may have never known that Utah is actually one of the states with, you know, highest per capita deaths of Black people by police.
Okay.
And actually, further too, Utah is also a state with 8 sovereign Native American tribes and reservations. And so, you know, it's a state that even though Native American women only make up 0.1% of the population, they make up 30% of all reported rape cases. And so in 2017, I co-founded a multicultural community activist group to address those issues. And it was, you know, centered on renaming a prominent landmark in Provo, Utah, where I was attending, you know, university at the time and finishing my bachelor's degree. And, you know, the name of the peak was Squaw Peak, which is a sexually derogatory term. And they're frequent throughout Utah. And so when we began this activist, you know, group, is we call it Repeak. That was in 2017. The community was pretty overwhelmingly negative towards the renaming initiative. And so I was working in the mayor's office at the time as an intern to work on the name change effort and everything. And he even withdrew his support of the initiative when he began his congressional election campaign because it was too controversial, an issue too left, you know. And so while we'd actively campaigned for the name change, we've been doing that for, you know, the past couple of years and pushing public education on the issue and whatnot, it became clear that it was going to take some time before, you know, to get the necessary support.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, you know, pushback. But during this time, just in the past 2 months, we've had a slew of concerned community members started reaching out in support. And just 2 weeks ago, one of Utah's state senators reached out to us and she said, this is the time to push this through. I'd really like to help you. And we just heard back from the Board of Geographic Names that they said if we get this, you know, as long as we get this in soon, that they're going to push for that name change. So it's brought a lot of things to light in Utah, is what I'm trying to say.
Wow, that's really great that this initiative, which has really been going on for a few years, that it's now finally getting the attention it deserves in this debate about racial injustice. I would like to sort of move on to a different place, your home state of Oregon. And of course, the attention has really been focused on Oregon, on Portland, Oregon in particular, since President Trump deployed federal agents there in early July to protect federal buildings. And of course, local authorities there feel that these forces are abusing their authority, that they're tear gassing protesters and pulling them into unmarked vans. That has gotten a lot of attention. Portland's mayor spoke of an attack on our democracy, and Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, even called the agents stormtroopers. I thought that was quite remarkable. From I'm sure you've been following these developments, and what impact do you think did this deployment of federal forces have on the protest movements in Portland?
Yeah, so by the time federal agents were sent, Black Lives Matter protests over George Floyd had kind of already subsided, more or less, and so they became revived with the arrival of, you know, the feds, who began dragging protesters in unmarked vans and whatnot, and, you know, which led to this, the Wall of Moms and others protesting for the protesters' sake.
Could you explain that quickly, the Wall of Moms?
Yeah, so with the happenings with the federal officers being sent in, there's been a nightly group of, you know, Portland mothers that come and basically make a wall, you know, to protect the protesters. And it's actually been a really cool thing to see that community come together in that way, and something maybe we haven't seen before.
That has become a demand that the federal forces leave. Has that become a central demand of the demonstrations, or is it more like an additional demand in addition to the demands for social justice and racial justice?
Yeah, it's kind of taken over. From what I've seen, is that that's kind of taken the front of the, you know, what initially started as a, you know, protest on racial injustice, Black Lives Matter. Although that shouldn't be discredited either. I know that Portland City Council passed like a budget change to the, you know, the police for the next year and whatnot, but it's basically turned into protests that be, you know, into anti-fascist protests, which have, you know, actually long been active in Portland.
So that's quite a complicated story, where about which groups are involved and about how the demands are changing, and really how this movement has resurged after it had really sort of quieted down a little bit. So this resurgence of the movement that you mentioned, is it limited to Portland, or have we seen it in other cities as well?
As of right now, I don't think with the same force as Portland, you know, where Trump's calling them anarchists who hate the country. I don't know if that's, we've really seen the same elsewhere. Oregon's really a special place for a lot of reasons. It's Portland in particular is dealt with a history of racist problems, but it also has a very active body of liberal activism that's, you know, been the Pacific Northwest and Portland in particular very known for that. I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing similar protests, however, in places like Chicago, New York, and other places where Trump has promised to, you know, use federal force.
Mm-hmm. So we sort of have to see how that develops. And of course, I can't let you off without a question about the election. And my question would be is do you think that the deployment of those federal forces to Portland has helped the president in his bid for re-election, or do you think it could backfire? I mean, we just heard yesterday that Oregon's governor announced that the forces would withdraw. We don't know whether that's really going to happen, but what do you think will be the impact of this on the elections?
So first of all, I think the act of deploying federal forces in Portland when the protests had, you know, more or less subsided was entirely political. You know, these battles between Trump and state Republicans and Democratic cities is really twofold. Trump is, you know, overwhelmingly unpopular in urban areas and cities throughout the U.S., but he's still really strong in rural places. And that was actually really clear on my this last month in Oregon. I'm from a smaller town a few hours south of Portland, And the difference between the rural outskirts and like the city center were politically night and day different. You could hardly drive a mile outside in the boonies, you know, without seeing the Trump sign. And then, you know, you gradually get into the city and it changed. And then you have places like Portland and Oregon that have long been known as, you know, incredibly liberal places where you'd be hard pressed to find even a Trump supporter, you know, it seems like. So as many, you know, a lot of political commentators have been stating, you know, I think the most immediate political question is definitely how suburban, you know, whites are going to respond to this. And so, is, you know, by provoking, you know, clashes with protesters in liberal places like Portland, it looks like he's trying to convince white suburban voters that he's, you know, kind of the last line of defense between them and, you know, the chaos of Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's working in places like Utah, to be honest. I think it's working. I know a lot of, you know, the surrounding suburbs of Salt Lake City are, you know, are seeing this and they're afraid, you know, after seeing police cars flipped in Salt Lake and whatnot, you know, just a couple months ago. I think in a lot of ways that Trump is gaining a lot of white middle class vote, just like he did in 2016, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. And just like Nixon did with law and order after
right.
the protests. Yeah, we'll sort of have to see how that pans out in 3 months in the November election. Well, thank you very much for this conversation, Terence, and for your insights. You have been listening to the podcast of the Heidelberg Center for American Studies at the University of Heidelberg. My name is Anja Schüler, and in the coming weeks, our podcast will continue to focus on some of the topics we discussed today. I will be talking to political scientist Florian Böller about polarization in U.S. society and politics, and I will be talking to historian Britta Waldschmidt-Nelson about the Black Lives Matter movement. So stay tuned, and most importantly, please stay safe and healthy.